Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. Senior lecturer in Roman history at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany. This is episode CLXIX, Gallus. When Decius died during a battle with the Goths, the Roman army took it upon themselves to appoint a successor, his remaining general, Trebonianus Gallus. Gallus was initially praised for not beginning a civil war, unusual for the time, we must admit, but would be unable to lead the empire through the turmoil that was to come. Here's Caelan Davenport.
Decius and his son, Herennius Etruscus, we last saw valiantly riding into battle against the Goths at the Battle of Abrutus in June 251. They sacrificed their lives heroically for the state. This, however, is only one tradition about their deaths, what we call the positive tradition. There is also a negative tradition that they were actually betrayed to the Goths by the governor of Moesia Inferior, Gaius Vibius Trebonianus Gallus. And this tradition is preserved in Zosimus, a Greek author writing in the 6th century, but he's probably relying on Dexippus, our 3rd century author. And Zosimus says, Book 1, 23.3, Decius, having destroyed a considerable number of the first battalion, the second advance, which he likewise defeated, and discovered part of the third, which lay near the marsh. Gallus sent intelligence to him that he might march against them across the fen. Proceeding, therefore, incautiously in an unknown place, he and his army became entangled in the mire, and under that disadvantage was so assailed by the missiles of the barbarians that not one of them escaped with life. Thus ended the life of the excellent Emperor Decius.
So it's just that one half a sentence, Gallus sent intelligence to him.
That's right. So when Decius, you know, rides into the marsh, you know, for that third unit, here we've been told it's Gallus who actually sends him across.
I know that the prospect of being the emperor is a very sexy prospect in the 3rd century, but I can't imagine Gallus doing this kind of thing, especially considering how much trouble the Goths caused for his province.
Yes, no, it's a stunning turnaround if we are to believe this turn of events. Personally, I don't buy it. There does seem to be this sort of tradition in Dexippus where local governors are actually allying themselves with the Goths. But you're right, having spent all this time trying to defend Roman territory, why would he then turn around for, you know, being an emperor in this kind of situation is not a very glamorous position, especially because the fact he then has to conclude a rather humiliating peace treaty with the Goths, which, you know, is not a good way to start a reign.
Mm-hmm. So take me through that. It's essentially a full capitulation. I'm paying you Goths to go away, which you already were in the process of doing, by the way.
Yes.
And I'm going to pay you to stay away.
That's right. We don't know how much. This comes from Zosimus, so we don't have any figure, but you know, the Goths are paid an annual subsidy, tribute, whatever you want to call it, to stay out of Roman territory. And they're also allowed to take with them the captives from Philippopolis, the Romans who are captured then. So that is a bit of a stunning turnaround. So I think, you know, this is the sense where the Romans have lost their successful, inspirational leader, Decius. Gallus is left on the scene, and then he has to try and make the best of the situation now that he is emperor.
It doesn't sound like the Romans get anything out of that deal at all, actually. So is it the army in this situation that proclaims him the emperor?
Yes, he would be the most senior other Roman official on the scene. Decius' son, who's with him, Herennius Etruscus, also died. So both Gallus and then his son, Gaius Vibius Volusianus, are proclaimed as Augustus and Caesar, respectively. We don't know what position his son had at the time, but they're the men the army turns to. But we do know, however, that one of Decius's other sons, Hostilianus, is still living. He's probably back in Rome, and he had already been made Augustus while Decius was still alive. So we're going to see what happens between these two different branches of the Imperial College.
I take it that's the Senate's decision to put Hostilianus. They've decided to go the hereditary route and keep the imperial line intact that way, have they?
It's difficult to know. We don't really know how negotiations between the parties took place. The chronology indicates that Hostilianus was already Augustus before Decius died. I mean, they theoretically could depose him, but they decided not to. We don't quite know how things went down. Zosimus says that Trebonianus Gallus came to Rome, recognized that Decius' son Hostilianus was also Augustus, and even adopted him. That's probably unlikely, but that's what Zosimus says. So there's a reconciliation there that brings them all together in one imperial college.
Okay, so can we do a bit of background now at this point on who Gallus is, what we know about him, and how he got to be in this position?
He's probably in his late 40s at this time. So he was born in the reign of Septimius Severus. And he comes from Perugia in central Italy. He's a man of Etruscan senatorial background, very similar to Decius's wife, Herennia Etruscilla. So I think this is really important. We often talk about the 3rd century AD as the age of the soldier emperors, which implies that they're men who sort of worked their way up from being soldiers to officers and then commanders. But that hasn't happened yet. We're getting conflict for the imperial throne between leading senators and, in some cases, leading equestrians. So Gallus is of great aristocratic pedigree. His wife, who has the wonderful name of Afinia Gemina Babiana, is probably also of senatorial family. And they also have a son who I've mentioned, Volusianus, who's probably about in his early 20s at this time. Some books will say they had a daughter, Vibia Galla. She's certainly a relative based on her names. We know her from an inscription, but there's no firm evidence that she was Gallus's daughter, as is sometimes claimed. We don't even know the precise date of the inscription there.
Okay, and what do we know about his career? I imagine that by the sounds of it, it was quite directed towards administration until he got to the governorship. Is that about right?
Well, we actually know very, very little about his career. Until recently, all we could surmise was that he was a consul and then governor of Moesia Inferior. That's all we knew. However, recently inscriptions have been discovered from Thrace, which shows that he was governor of that province under Philip. So we have what is, as far as we know, is a fairly standard senatorial career, you know, working his way up to the cursus honorum and governing provinces. But, you know, he clearly knew the Balkans very well since he had been governor of Thrace and governor of Moesia Inferior.
So what can we say that we know about Gallus then? We've got a statue that's attributed to him. And from that, you can maybe get a sense of the sort of person he was, can you?
Or at least, you know, the image that he and his administration wanted to protect. There's a magnificent bronze statue, which is now in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. It's monumental in size. He's 241 centimeters tall. He doesn't have an inscription saying this is Trebonianus Gallus, so we can't be definitely sure. But he's depicted in heroic nudity with strong chest and arms. His head is very similar to the portraits of Gallus we see on his coinage. You know, he's wearing the close-cropped military hairstyle and beard. It's also, in terms of the way it displays the emperor, it's quite similar to a statue of Trajan Decius, which also shows him in heroic nudity. It's marble, the Decius one, and it can be seen in the Centrale Montemartini Museum in Rome. So they both project the similar image of the heroic, masculine, virile soldier emperor who can defend Rome and its borders.
It tells a good story, but the identification of that statue kind of worries me the more I looked into it. Like, it's attributed as being Gallus, but nobody seems to know where that attribution came from.
This is the problem with a lot of third century emperors, is you don't have a huge corpus of portraiture to draw upon, which, you know, quite different from, say, you know, a Hadrian or an Augustus, for example. So you are dealing with very small sample size. So any judgment will have to be made on artistic grounds and also the gut feeling of the historian or the art historian.
So your gut feeling is it's him?
Oh, I think it's him.
Cool. I like that. Okay. All right. I'm happy with that. All right. It's also a vote in confidence of the barrel-chested emperor.
Yes.
Gives me hope. So what was Gallus's interaction then with the Imperial College? He's got his bad deal. He's got an army, or what's left of an army, which I guess is important. And Rome is there for the taking.
When he's in Rome, there are obviously some sort of negotiations there, but clearly Gallus and Volusianus are going to rule together with Hostilianus, Decius' son. Accordingly, Decius and Herennius Etruscus are deified, which shows, you know, the reverence towards them and their sacrifice by the new regime. We don't know what happens to Herennia Etruscilla, Decius's wife. Like many third century imperial women, they just disappear off the page. Given that she was from the same area as Gallus, you know, obviously there were connections there. I mean, she could have lived for another 20 years in relative peace and quiet in Rome, or she could have died that same year. We just don't know.
The fact that he didn't come in and put Hostilianus to death, but actually, you know, made him a co-emperor for a while at least, seems to indicate, you know, he's smart enough to not want another civil war. I mean, I know I'm inferring a lot here, or he's, you know, got enough fondness for the memory of Decius to deify him and keep his family intact and honor his wishes to some extent. I don't know. I'm inferring a lot.
No, it's okay, Matt. It's the third century. Conjecture is the order of the day.
Sure, yeah.
No, it's true. I mean, you know, we have very little to go on with many of these emperors. To me, it suggests, you know, that he didn't betray Decius, that actually he's trying to continue on with his legacy and working with his family. However, very soon there is an unexpected event. And that is that sometime in the second half of 251, possibly as early as July, Hostilianus dies. And Volusianus is promoted to the rank of Augustus with his father. Now, Zosimus lays the blame directly at Gallus's feet. This is in Book 1, Chapter 25. And Zosimus says that he contrived the young man's destruction without regard either to his own adoption of him or to common honour and justice. And this is because he allegedly feared Hostilianus would be a rallying point for those who supported Decius. And this sort of fits into this image we get through Zosimus of Gallus as a rather disreputable character. However, there's actually a much more likely reason. That is that Hostilianus died of the plague. And this is the reason given by both Aurelius Victor and the so-called epitome on the Caesars, the Epitome de Caesaribus. He died that summer when the plague ravaged Rome. This is what we call the plague of Cyprian.
So tell me about this plague, because this is a significant pressure that comes upon Rome in the next good 20 years or so. Rome is dealing with internal and external conflict. They're dealing with economic pressures. They're dealing with being ravaged by a plague. This is like all the ingredients that will essentially crumble Rome within the next 50 years to some extent and lead to a big stint of rebuilding.
Yes, I mean, this is a plague which for many years has sort of flown under the radar. I mean, you know, we talk about the Antonine Plague, we talk about the Justinianic Plague, you know, we talk about the plague that happened in Athens, but the mid-third century plague has as I said, gone largely unnoticed despite the number of literary sources talking about it. And it's only really in the past 5-6 years or so, thanks to an article and a book, The Fate of Rome by Kyle Harper, and a more recent article by Sabina Hubner, that we can actually appreciate the full scale of this plague and the problems which it caused throughout the Roman Empire.
Can we start with why is it called the Cyprian Plague?
Yes, yes, I think that's a good point. He did not start it. It's called the Plague of Cyprian. You might remember that he was the Bishop of Carthage. We met him when we talked about Trajan Decius and his Edict of Sacrifice. So it's named after him simply because he gives the best descriptions of its effects in his letters. There are also mentions of it in the correspondence of Dionysius, who was Bishop of Alexandria. And we have these letters because they were later quoted by the Christian historian Eusebius early in the 4th century.
So what is Cyprian telling us about the plague then?
He says his symptoms include eye pain at the beginning and can later result in blindness. One experiences fevers, aching limbs, vomiting, and even putrefying body parts towards the end. So it's not a very pleasant experience. Quite what it actually is in scientific terms is unknown. It's very difficult to diagnose diseases based on descriptions in ancient authors. And so Harper dismisses it being a bubonic plague or something like that. He says it's a viral hemorrhagic fever, which causes very similar symptoms to those described by Cyprian.
And was the reign of Gallus the first encounter that we get to it, or was it in Rome earlier than that?
So this is where there's a bit of scholarly debate. So Kyle Harper argues the plague started in Egypt about 249, this beginning of Decius's reign, and then spread to Rome by early 251. So ideally placed to kill off poor Hostilianus later that year. And the major regions affected by the plague at this point seem to be, in addition to Egypt and Italy, the Balkans, Turkey, and Syria. So, for example, we're not finding it in Spain or Britain.
The Western provinces.
Exactly, exactly, apart from Italy. However, just this year, in an article in the Journal of Roman Archaeology, Sabine Hübner has argued for a different interpretation, which actually takes us back to the Gothic War in the Balkans. So her argument is quite complicated. So firstly, she proposes that Hostilianus did not remain in Rome, as generally accepted, but actually accompanied his father Decius and his brother Etruscus on the Gothic campaign. The evidence for this that she presents are coins which come from the mint of Viminacium in that area, which are being minted for Hostilianus. If this is true, it means that the negotiations between Tribonianus Gallus and Hostilianus after Decius' death all took place in the Balkans, not in Rome. I'm not convinced that the coins actually attest Hostilianus's presence myself. There are a number of reasons why the mint might produce coins for him. Certainly his father and brother are in the area, and so, you know, they'll produce coins for all members of the Imperial College. Paying the troops is always going to be a concern. There's been a lot of debate when you're looking at what we call provincial coinage, to what extent it actually attests the movement of emperors, and the evidence is inconclusive. So I'm not convinced on that ground. She also cites a mausoleum there which could be suitable for an emperor. Again, I don't find that particularly convincing in and of itself. Her article in the Journal of Roman Archaeology is open access, so everyone can go to the journal's website and read it and reach your own conclusions.
So what's the argument then that Hostilianus was up north in Moesia and has caught the Cyprian plague from a Goth?
Well, he's caught the plague there, yes. So he's caught the plague on the scene. So Zosimus actually locates the beginning of the plague in Gallus's reign. And so Sabine Hübner argues the pestilence actually began in the Balkans amongst the Roman army. because over 13,000 graves have been found in Viminacium, suggesting it could be the ground zero for the spread of the plague and moved from there outwards to Italy, Egypt, and Turkey. One of the problems, however, is, and you know, she points to this as further research, is that no one's done any genomic sequencing yet on these bodies which are there, so they could simply be casualties of war, not from the plague. So she does bring up the different dating in the sources, and she uses this to construct an alternative scenario there. I think the jury is still out, but, you know, we should give credit to both of these scholars for actually bringing this to our attention and, you know, showing us that this is a significant outbreak. And certainly, whatever you think of the origins, it makes Hostilianus's death as a result of a plague very plausible. And so it sort of rehabilitates Gallus, and we can put aside, you know, the image of him as a conniving emperor.
Okay, so there's a plague that's beginning to go through Rome. What else is Gallus dealing with during his reign? Do we know anything else about the challenges that he's facing?
Yes, so there's two other major problems. The first is that the Persian Shahanshah, Shapur, invades Syria and actually manages to capture the capital city of Antioch, which, of course, is the largest Roman city in the region. This is a major blow. We'll talk more about this and its ramifications when we deal with the Emperor Valerian. But certainly, this was a crisis that would have affected Gallus. The second problem is that the Goths, once again, despite having been paid off, not only invade Moesia, but also take to the sea. So they sail down from the Black Sea through the Hellespont, so past modern-day Istanbul, down the coast of western Turkey. They ravage the interior. They sack Ephesus. According to Giordani's Getica, this is when the Temple of Artemis Ephesus is burned. So there's problems in what has been a relatively peaceful province, you know, of Asia, and then also, you know, Pontus and Bithynia, that normally you would expect an emperor to take to the field. We don't actually know what Gallus and Volusianus did. His reign is so short that we don't know, for example, if they were preparing to gather troops together to go to the east in person. We just don't know.
So if Gallus isn't responsible for resolving this situation, who does? Is there a Roman that rides to our aid?
Yes, so there is one successful military commander in the Balkans by the name of Aemilius Aemilianus. He's governor of Moesia Superior, and we know that he came from Gerber, which is an island off the coast of North Africa in modern Tunisia. Aemilianus is victorious against the Goths, and he's proclaimed emperor by his troops, as you do, because, you know, as soon as someone's successful, their troops say, well, no, we'll have you instead. And Aemilianus doesn't wait. He marches straight towards Italy to take the fight to Gallus there. Gallus senses he's going to need help. You know, there's only one legion in Italy, the Second Parthian Legion, which is at Alba. So he turns to the senatorial commander, Publius Licinius Valerianus, who seems to be the governor of the province of Raetia. So this is sort of southern Germany, northern Austria, eastern Switzerland area. And he says, you know, you've got to help me, Valerianus. Can you please bring troops to Italy? But Aemilianus gets there first. He's there in Italy before Valerianus gets there. Gallus and Volusianus march to meet him in battle, but they are murdered by their own troops at Interamna in Umbria in the August of 253. And his troops then defect to Aemilianus.
Wow, so that's it. So you got like Gallus. 2 years.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes, just over 2 years.
Okay, it's so strange being, you know, done with emperors one after the other in these episodes. So
it just shows the instability of the political situation, that there is this desire amongst the army that as soon as someone wins a victory, you know, they're capable of being emperor, which of course results which results in a civil war, but it just shows how fraught the military situation is on the frontiers. You're only as good as your last victory.
And I can't help but wonder if Valerianus maybe, you know, oh, I didn't get the letter in time, so sorry about that. And now, spoiler alert, I'm going to go and mop up the pieces after it's all done.
Yes.
So all hail Emperor Aemilianus. Mm. And he then goes to Rome.
Yeah, so there's a nice little excerpt here in the 6th century Byzantine historian Peter the Patrician, in which he writes to the Senate to say, I leave the realm to you, and I will strive in every way as your general. The idea is, you know, you can handle the administration, and you know, I will be the commander on the frontiers. As Zenarus, who's also a Byzantine source, preserves a similar story in which Aemilianus says he will expel the barbarians from Thrace, and he will also deal with the Persian threat in the east. So there's a sense here that he's proclaiming that this is his job as emperor.
That's really interesting and must have been a very tempting proposition for the Senate, who haven't had power for quite a long time, effective power.
Yeah, I'm not sure to what extent he actually means power, more of the sense of, you know, this is my job as emperor. You can handle the day-to-day administration. We don't know enough about the personalities of the period to be able to say more. We have to look at it in the terms of how the emperors represented themselves and how their role was understood.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess at the very least, it's knowing the limitations of his abilities. You know, I'm a general. I've got things to take care of over here.
Yeah, certainly, certainly.
So very quickly, we're going to be meeting yet another new emperor. So the third one for the episode. So how does that come about?
Yes, unfortunately, poor Aemilianus started off so promisingly, only lasts 88 days as emperor. And this is because Valerianus and his troops are marching in to Italy, and Aemilianus is now murdered by his own forces at Spoleto in central Italy, which is a very nice hillside town if you go and visit it.
I don't think Aemilianus thought so.
No. It was not good for Aemilianus there. It's quite interesting as well to mention, you know, that these emperors are dying and being murdered by their troops actually in central Italy, that we actually have these armies marching through Italy and contesting the throne. It brings us back to, you know, the civil wars of the late Republic in some ways that we haven't seen for a while. So Valerian, well, as we'll now call him, he's a senator in his early 50s. He becomes emperor. And he's going to found a new dynasty, which would last for 15 years until 268. So when we return, we'll be spending quite a bit of time with them.
A long time in the 3rd century for these sort of things. He would have seen his actions, and I guess we can get into this more in the next episode. He would have seen his actions as avenging the death of Gallus.
Definitely.
Avenging the death of the emperor, and Aemilianus almost as being a usurper.
Definitely. No, he's coming in. You know, he was summoned by Gallus. But once again, it's actually the troops that are taking these actions. You know, they're the ones that are claiming emperors and also murdering them when, you know, there's a better offer on the table. But you might think, why would anyone want to be emperor? But then, you know, there's a thought that, you know, the army says, we'll acclaim you emperor. And it's sort of like, you know, you have a knife to your throat, you know, you will be emperor, won't you? Because, you know, one of the choices is they're going to be. But, you know, I'll just run, take a horse and, you know, flee.
Okay, so now that we're essentially bringing to end a phase of the time in the 3rd century, and we're going to be entering yet another phase. So what's the distinction? And can you give me a bit of a summary of what Rome is at this point?
Well, certainly in the period since the murder of Severus Alexander in 235, we've seen a series of short-lived emperors. The longest was Gordian III from 238 to 244. So no one's lasted more than 6 years, despite there being 13 emperors in this period. So considerable turnover. We've seen threats in the Balkan areas, particularly from the Goths. And we've seen problems in the east with Gordian III's Persian War and then the humiliating peace treaty made by Philip. So there are external problems. There are also internal issues. Although senators are still commanding armies, they're still viable candidates, the purple. We do have, you know, the equestrian officer Maximinus, and we do have the equestrian praetorian prefect Philip, who are becoming emperors. So there's becoming more of a sense that it doesn't have to be a senator. And now we have the plague, Plague of Cyprian, ravaging the empire as well. So it's a time of pressure on multiple levels, on multiple fronts.
And just as a bit of a teaser, what's that going to do in the next phase of the third century?
Well, what's quite fascinating about Valerian is that he has a son, Gallienus, and Gallienus himself has two sons, Valerian the Younger and Saturninus, and they come together as an imperial college, which means that you can have different emperors in different regions of the empire dealing with threats. So it's a really interesting way of tackling these issues. We also see Valerian and Gallienus putting in new command structures, which change the way in which people can be promoted in the army, and does eventually lead to the ability of men to rise from the ranks to holding positions as officer and general. Under Gallienus, there are problems. There's revolts in the west. Postumus founds what we call the so-called Gallic Empire. And then in the east, we have what we call the Palmyrene Empire. And so Gallienus largely controls only the central portion of the Roman world. And this is all sparked by the humiliating defeat of Valerian and his army in battle against Shapur in 260, in which Valerian is actually captured and becomes a prisoner of war.
That's Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow myself and Kaelin on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. In the next episode, we will be looking at Roman luxury and wealth. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.